Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, it's Mo, and you are listening to Sex, Love, and Rock and Roll Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to sex, dating, and relationships that are outside of the box, non-normative, and designed to inspire you to live more authentically and by your own rules. By breaking down myths and looking at social constructs, my goal is to inspire you to have a better, safer, more informed sex, dating, and love life. No rock unturned. Now that is rock and roll.
All right. So to start, will you tell us your name and title and profession?
I'm Jessica Graham, and I'm the author of a book called Good Sex, Getting Off Without Checking Out. And it's about bringing mindfulness and spirituality into your sex life. So I'm also a meditation teacher and a filmmaker and an actor. I do a bunch of stuff, but one of my passions is helping people have better sex.
Okay, great. So do you identify as female?
I do.
Okay, perfect. Now, do you identify as gay, straight, queer, trans, or other?
I'm just like good old-fashioned bisexual.
Okay.
I like to state that I'm bisexual because it's a label that kind of gets the short end of the stick. You know, it's like, it's not really cool to be bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I mean, when I was younger coming up in the 90s, it was really not cool because it was, in the lesbian community, it was like, oh, you're bisexual. In the straight community, it was like, oh, you're slutty or you're confused. And now it's almost like, it's interesting because there's so many different ways we can identify, and the bisexual one feels like it's like the not cool one, but I'm all for the underdog, and it's true. I truly am bisexual, and I have been since I was a very little girl. So.
Yeah, it's a true label.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to, it was never cool back then, right? And now it's kind of like not cool because it's not this like new, it's sort of, you know, gender binary.
Right, exactly.
Right. All right, cool. So now, do you identify as monogamous, or do you identify as something other than monogamous?
I would say, I mean, I absolutely can be monogamous. I would say that if I had to identify, if someone said, all right, you have to make a choice, this is the moment, you must make it, I would say I'm non-monogamous. That's more natural to me. That's something, again, since I was quite young, that's kind of just been the way that I am. Some of that could have to do with how I was raised. I was raised by these lovely and terrible wolves.
Okay.
You know, but there was just so much sort of non-traditional experiences in my childhood. So I think I was kind of wired to be a non-traditional person in lots of ways, including in my sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say I'm definitely of the belief or in the camp that monogamy is not necessarily natural for humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why we see so many people doing it so unsuccessfully. I think we'd do it a lot more successfully, monogamy, if we talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And talked about the fact that, oh, actually, that's not a natural thing to just fall in love with one person and just only want them for the rest of your life. Whether you make the choice to only be with them for the rest of your life is different than thinking you're supposed to only want them.
Right, right. Setting them up for failure, so
exactly.
To speak, right? Because
exactly.
They think that they're supposed to be that way, and then something else happens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, what about serial monogamy?
I think it's problematic because it doesn't leave a lot of space for growing in between.
Okay.
If by serial monogamy you mean like just one into the next, into the next, into the next?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like when you said that monogamy doesn't seem like it's natural, I feel like as I think back to most of the people I know, and probably yourself as well, non-monogamy is not something that we see a lot in our society. What we do see is serial monogamy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people in a long-term relationship for maybe 3 years, 5 years, whatever, and then in another one. There might be time in between, and there might not be.
Okay, well then, yeah, in that context. So what do I think about serial monogamy?
I guess what I'm asking you is that more natural?
I think non-monogamy is more natural.
Okay.
I do. That doesn't mean that it's more culturally acceptable or more sort of natural or necessarily easy,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm fully in support of serial monogamy in the way that you described it, and I've been...
That seems to be the more acceptable way of, you know, our culture, I guess, being monogamous, but not necessarily being non-monogamous and being able to switch partners within that monogamous frame.
Right, yeah. Right.
Do you believe the idea that monogamy falls on a continuum?
I've definitely come across people who, in a very healthy way, would never be non-monogamous. You know, it's not because they're scared of it. It's not because they have a bunch of abandonment issues that they haven't worked through. It's just simply that's what works for them. That's
mm-hmm.
what feels right in their body. And then met other people that it's very, very healthy for them to have many partners, and it's not based on a feeling of lack, and it's not based on, you know, some sort of childhood issue. It's just naturally who they are and
mm-hmm.
how they are. So yeah, I would agree that it's on a continuum. I think that even that conversation is one that doesn't really nobody's having that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are right now. But, but I think even opening up to the idea that, yeah, some people are less likely to be attracted to only one person or to want to be with only one person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that it could potentially flow, ebb and flow at different times of your life as well.
Mm. Absolutely. Because I'll say that I was always sort of wired to be non-monogamous, but I had a lot of issue around jealousy because I had a lot of abandonment issues
mm-hmm.
and a lot of sort of self-love issues. There was not a lot of it that I was capable of giving myself. And so between those two things, whenever I rubbed up against something slightly non-monogamous, it would trigger so much in me,
mm-hmm.
so much of
mm-hmm.
that abandonment
mm-hmm.
stuff,
mm-hmm.
that I couldn't tolerate it. And so I could tolerate me being with other people, but I couldn't tolerate my partners being with other people. And it wasn't until I really addressed those sort of deeply ingrained beliefs and patterns and neural pathways did it start to change. But even now, you know, circumstances in my life can cause me to choose to be monogamous or to choose to be non-monogamous, depending on what's happening with my partner, depending
mm-hmm.
on what's happening in my own personal life. Sometimes there's just not enough time to be non-monogamous.
It is an issue of time more than it is of the capacity or the capability to love.
Right, exactly.
Can you talk more about, I really like that, because your book is about that a lot, the self-love aspect, and how that plays a role in monogamy, because you hit on it a second ago that you had a lot of issues with jealousy, and how we use monogamy as sort of like this way to keep us safe from jealousy,
mm-hmm.
you know?
So I do think that we tend to use monogamy to feel more safe and to feel more stable and secure. And I want to talk first in the macro, and that is that we are not safe. We are not stable. There is no solid ground beneath us. We are on a rock that's spinning around in the midst of endless space. Okay? And we have no control over any of it.
Mm-hmm.
What we do have control over is how we relate to our minds and how we relate to our bodies. We don't really have control over our minds or our bodies, but how we relate to them, how we work with them. We have some control there. And so that's where we start to get into a space where we can make change. But I think this sort of like total sort of broad lack of control that everybody is rubbing up against every day, the fact that we're all going to die, the fact that we have no idea about so much. I think people want to grasp onto things to feel safe and to feel stable because they know somewhere deep inside that they're not. And so monogamy is one place where we can do that. We can say, this is my person, this is my life, this is what I believe, this is how it is. I am this solid entity, this person is part of that solid entity, I am safe. And that's why when someone cheats or when someone dies or when life things happen, it can feel like everything's falling apart. Your identity's crumbling because you're so identified with this little thing you've created and believed to be real and solid. So that's the macro.
Mm-hmm.
On the micro, yes, I think the idea is that it's safer and easier to be monogamous. But unfortunately, many people are not doing that in a conscious way. So they're not consciously monogamous. They're monogamous, they're sort of like, okay, I'll do this. Maybe I'll do this for the most part, except that one time I went on that trip to Colorado and I met that girl and we just did that one thing and I'm never going to tell my wife about it. So it's like, but I'm monogamous, you know? Or I'm just going to like white knuckle it and be monogamous, you know? And I'm not going to talk about any of those feelings or any of those thoughts or any of those things that I might have done and not told. And that creates a real distance. And that creates a real lack of intimacy, because this is a huge part of being human, sexuality and sexual expression. It's biological. It's part of what makes us us. And when we exclude that from the conversation, whether it's between with our partner or in a larger context, we're ignoring this huge part of being human, right? And I think there is that idea in romantic relationship, not just with monogamy and issues of monogamy, but also just in general, we shut down parts of ourselves and we hold back parts of ourselves and we try to alter parts of ourselves so that we can come together to form what we think it's supposed to be, this perfect union of these two people who are getting married and going to be in love forever.
Mm-hmm.
And we end up really cutting off huge parts of ourselves for the sake of being safe or being secure, but it really, I think, does the opposite, because over time, that lack of intimacy and that dishonesty, it erodes the connection between two people.
Yeah, when I hear you talk about it, it sounds so isolating almost,
yeah,
right?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think it is. I think a lot of people are very alone in their relationships. That's what I found. In working with people around sexuality, you know, not only are they not having conversations about monogamy, they're also not looking into each other's eyes while they're having sex. They're mm-hmm. also, you know, not at all in their bodies while they're receiving pleasure. It's this kind of disconnect, this shutdown that happens, because that level of intimacy is really scary for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, where are we going to be our true selves? Where are we going to be authentic in our sexuality and our personality if not with our partner? If that's not happening, then there's this huge experience of life that's not happening.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to add about your experiences with monogamy or non-monogamy?
Sure. I'll talk a little bit about my experience with jealousy, because it seems to be one of the favorite topics
mm-hmm,
of
mm-hmm.
both people, non-monogamous and monogamous. It's
yeah.
the one that comes up.
And
so yeah, so for me, because of some faulty wiring, you know, a brain that sort of was wired towards, I'm going to get hurt, I'm going to be left alone, I'm not good enough. When I started to approach in a very conscious, mindful way, the idea of non-monogamy, I knew full well that all of that stuff was going to come up. And honestly, that's part of the reason I wanted to explore it, was because I'm very much like a spiritual, psycho-spiritual adventurer, I guess. Yeah. I'm a psycho-spiritual adventurer.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to go into that material, and I knew there weren't a whole lot of other ways to get at it quite like that.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I just really enjoy people, and I really enjoy sex, so it was like kind of worked together. But I did have to work through that stuff, and for about 2 weeks, I was in hell. I was crying nonstop. I was in and out of states of fight, flight, freeze. I was totally triggered. But the good news was that I had all these years of a meditation practice and a lot of therapy and all of that, and so I was able to witness the experience without fully getting pulled into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get pulled in for moments, and I would, you know, act a fool. And then I would recognize it, and I'd be like, oh, okay, I see what's happening, and I would step back out. And so I was able to kind of come up for breath throughout those 2 weeks. But at the end of those 2 weeks of sitting with and walking with and working with, like it was just always with me, that experience of not just the very old wounds, but also the times I was cheated on, or the times I cheated, or the times there was dishonesty in one way or another, there was just a lot of material that wanted to surface and process through. So once I sat with that for that period of time, I was literally a different person. I had changed, I feel like, on a cellular level. I was, there was all this space and all this freedom that hadn't been there before, because all these wounds that had been informing all of my emotional relationships had begun to heal in really significant ways. And I remember at that time, you know, reading books like The Ethical Slut or Opening Up, and it's saying things like, oh yeah, you know, you'll eventually just feel like a twinge of jealousy. And I was like, I don't know how that could ever be true. And I can say that after that period of time, and, you know, continuing months after in a more, in a less extreme way, that's the experience. It's just a twinge.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, because it's not tapping into a bunch of open, festering wounds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what people run into with non-monogamy, is they don't recognize, not only are they going to have to work through the biological stuff around monogamy, like, oh, if my caveman leaves and goes to another cavewoman, I might starve. You know, there is sort of a biological thing
in
there.
Sure.
And then they also are going to have to work through all the emotional and the psychological, and it's pretty intense, and you need tools to do that, unless you're just totally chill and have none of those issues, and you're with someone who has none of those issues, and maybe it can be super easy.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, I think that's where I see people stumble in the whole non-monogamy thing, is not having the appropriate tools to work through everything that's going to come up, and then either shutting it down because it's too scary,
mm-hmm.
or really acting out. And I did versions of both of those. You know, I've definitely not ever done non-monogamy perfectly, just like I haven't done any kind of relationship perfectly.
Right.
Because we're not perfect.
Right.
But you can get better bit by bit, and the way that I see that happen for myself and for my students and my clients and my friends is that you just keep bringing the attention back to what wants to be healed, what's feeling unlovable, what's feeling not good enough, what part of me needs compassion and love in this moment and acceptance and awareness to be pointed at it, and how can I do my part? Because the tendency is, like, you put it on the other people. It's like, oh, they're doing it wrong, and they're making me feel bad. If you have that tool of being able to turn it back around instead of the, you know, the magnifying glass, the mirror,
mm-hmm.
and really look at yourself and what's actually coming up and what wants to heal and be resolved, well, then it's like non-monogamy becomes, like, a spiritual and emotional, like, supercharge, like,
mm-hmm.
spiritual and emotional growth supercharge.
It forces you to look at yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And grow, unless you want to be really uncomfortable. You know, I mean, it's like, it's super uncomfortable to just be in that, like, I don't want to look at it, but it's coming up. I don't want to look
right,
at it, but
right,
it's coming
right,
up.
Right, right, right.
Oh, that's not a fun place to be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so it's actually good to throw yourself into non-monogamy if you want to grow.
I think so, or not everyone's going to want to be non-monogamy. I think the other option is throw yourself into very conscious monogamy.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning you don't pretend that you don't have eyes. You don't pretend that you don't have a nose. I mean, someone can walk by and have a certain smell and it can turn you on. And to pretend like that's not happening and to ignore that it doesn't lead to growth.
Right.
It's not like you have to go run after them and have them for lunch, you know, but like, it's like you've got to be willing to look at it and talk to your partner about the fact that that's happened.
Right. Right.
You know, because it's a normal human thing.
Right. Couples are not talking about that. They're acting like they don't see others or they don't smell others.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's the thing. Like, if it's not talked about and it's a secret thing, that's when things start to get sticky. It's like, if you go home and you say, you know, to your partner, hey, you know, at work today this new person came in and I was really attracted to her and we had like a really kind of deep conversation and it felt kind of weird to connect with her so deeply and, you know, she was really attractive and it felt weird and I want to share it with you. That most likely, if you're both on board for the conscious monogamy thing, is going to lead to more intimacy with your partner. Maybe a threesome with a woman from work, and I don't know, and just more honesty and openness.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you just hold that in, suddenly becomes this thing.
It's
this story. And then every day you're going in and you're like, oh God, and then it's like this whole drama.
You're building something up around something that really it doesn't even need to be anything.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Anything else? Like, I have a bunch of questions here, so.
It's interesting with the polyamorous community, how rigid it can sometimes be. There's been times sort of when I was really starting to consciously explore this stuff where I reached out to the polyamorous community with feelings of jealousy or with fears or with wanting to set certain boundaries, and I would get sort of scolded, like if there was any hierarchy, going on in my relationship, if there was jealousy, there would be this sense of like, well, if you were really pure in your polyamory lifestyle, you would not feel that way. And so I don't at all identify as polyamorous. I don't like the label. It's not that I have any problem with anyone else using it, but it doesn't feel like it fits me because I'm someone that likes to have my person and I like to have my home and I like to have like my, like
your domain.
Yeah, and because of the fact that there's nothing really stable or solid and nothing that we can really control, mm-hmm. it's nice to have that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if it's an illusion that there's stability and safety, it's still nice to have that person. So for me, it's like I've had polyamorous friends kind of like poke at me and be like, you're a swinger, you know, which is sort of like this.
It's the negative way of saying you just want sex.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And it sort of has this sleazy connotation, and in the polyamorous community, it's very, like, little swingers. But I also don't identify with that. Like, I don't identify with that label, so it's funny sort of finding where I and, like, like-hearted people, like-minded people fit within all of those labels, because I haven't found a place where I fit within those labels. For me, it really always comes back to this idea of the fluidity that it is just to be human. We're constantly changing, we're constantly shifting as circumstances shift, as healing occurs. For example, look, I like to be tied up and beat a little bit like any other gal, but I used to really like it. I was very into it. And when I did a certain amount of healing, it stopped being as appealing to me, which is interesting, right? Like, and I'm not in any way, shape, or form saying that people who are into BDSM have issues. It's not, actually, I think they're some of the most mindful, conscious people out there having sex. But for me, the desire to be hurt and hurt badly went away when I stopped hating myself. And now, while I still will engage in some ways in that sort of sexual play, it doesn't have nearly as much charge for me as it used to. And it's just really interesting. It happened very sort of slowly and subtly. It wasn't like just one day. It was like over time, I shifted and changed. And I think one of the problematic things about labeling oneself is that you become identified with that label.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you start to change and shift, if it doesn't fit within that label, you might shut it down. Or you might push even harder in the other direction because that's your identity. This is who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a polyamorous person that doesn't believe in marriage. And now I want to get married. Oh, just can't do it.
Right.
Or vice versa,
yeah.
You know? And so when it comes to all those labels, for me, they're helpful. Like, I use the label bisexual because it fits.
Yeah,
I like men and women. But that's, you know, that's why even when I was quite young, even when I was, like, in my early 20s and I was really starting to date women in a more serious way, I didn't call myself a lesbian, even when I wanted to, because it felt good, because it was like, I'm a lesbian, and I like women, and I knew some part of me was like, yeah, but that's not fully true. That's not, even though I only dated women for a good 7 years, I knew it wasn't true for me to put that label on myself.
Yeah. So it sounds like you like to integrate all parts at all times, and just whatever happens, happens.
I do, and it's kind of hell for people sometimes.
Well, because like you said, most people want to be in a box. Put themselves in boxes and put each other in boxes and stay there and kind of like have some life in that box. It would make it really easy if we could.
Yeah, and I think people do it with some success, but I don't know how happy their lives are.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I definitely have plenty of people in my life and in my circle who just want a very simple life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about cutting parts off. It's just about how do we simplify and put the most energy in the places that are most important.
Right.
And you know, I really relate to that because, like, just, like, over the last year or so, I've been very focused on career, very focused on my book, very focused on my film work, and there hasn't been as much energy to put out there into that realm.
Mm-hmm.
of, you know, expressing my sexuality in that way. And again, like, if I was if I labeled myself as, like, this or that, it might
you'd be forced.
I was like, no, I have to have four partners. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
right, right.
So, yeah. So, I think it's really about, like, with the way we live in general, it's really about accepting and acknowledging and embracing the impermanence and the fluidity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think all of this fits really nicely into the sex work stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
Because typically sex work is not something that society, you know, society grounds on sex work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most aspects of it, porn for sure,
mm-hmm.
prostitution for sure. There's very few aspects of sex work that are actually even legal. Like, you can, I mean, do you watch porn yourself? Maybe we can.
Yeah, we can totally start there. So I am pro porn, much to the alarm of some of the people I know.
The meditation community is not pro.
Some of the people I come in contact with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a meditation teacher.
Right.
Who's pro porn. I'm a feminist who's pro porn. But I'm pro porn in a specific way. I'm pro ethical porn being consumed in a mindful and conscious way.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the porn consumption is not being done in a mindful, conscious way, and it is not ethical content. And so I am definitely not pro young women from the Midwest being exploited to come out here, getting thrown in, you know, their first scene and then another one and then a gangbang and then an extreme BDSM scene and then being washed up and done. And that happens. These girls, it's like factory farming. I'm not pro that. And I'm not pro what porn has done to young men's sexuality or what it's done to young women's sexuality. I think there's a lot of issue, right? And a lot of room for improvement. But you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Porn is actually something that can be incredibly healing. It can obviously be incredibly great for intimacy with yourself and with other people. So what I try to talk about and what I teach about is A, how to find ethical porn, and B, how to engage with porn in a way that's not addictive or hurtful to you or the people in your life. So there are tons of ethical porn companies out there. There are lots of people making content. You know, other than that, you can get clips for free that are ethical, but they're going to be very limited. It's not going to be like going on Pornhub or any of those other sites and getting, like, as much as you could possibly want for free. It's going to be a limited number of clips they're going to let you see and a limited portion of those clips. So what you can do if you, you know, want a little bit more porn is you can easily get memberships on many of these different sites, and they have them for whatever you're into. You know, if you're, like, a feminist lesbian who wants porn that really is coming from that perspective, you can get that. If you're a dude who's really into watching women get beat, then you can get that. And it's going to be made